You're listening to Like the Wolf, a Nero Wolf podcast.
Hello and welcome to Like the Wolf, a podcast looking at the Nero Wolf book series. My name's Jeff and I'll be your host today. Normally, each episode, we look at one of Rex Stout's novels in his long-running mystery series. Today, however, I'll continue with the occasional series where I talk with a Nero Wolf aficionado. Today, I'm speaking with author Steve Hockensmith. Steve initially worked in journalism, writing for such outlets as The Hollywood Reporter and Chicago Tribune, before turning to novels. His first book, Homes on the Range, was a finalist for numerous mystery awards, including the Edgar and Anthony. He's gone on to write more novels in his Western mystery series, as well as bounce around such varied genres as Victorian zombies, Kit Lit, and tarot mysteries. Also, due to an agreement between the Authors Guild and podcasters, I am legally obligated to mention that Steve is a New York Times best-selling author. Steve, thanks so much for taking the time to talk with me about Rex Stout's work.
It is my pleasure, especially hearing the New York Times best-selling author phrase. Like, if that's not worth getting out of bed a little early for on a Saturday morning, I don't know what is.
Well, I was hoping you'd tell me a bit about when you first started reading mystery novels and maybe the first mysteries you remember reading. Were you all in on the genre from the start, or did it kind of slowly grow on you?
It would be more sort of a slowly grow thing, sort of a moss kind of effect it had on me. And then it's accumulated to quite a thick peat these days, fortunately. But to really overextend a metaphor, but believe me, folks, my writing is better than that metaphor. But yeah, you know, the deal with me and mysteries was, you know, very much like probably many Americans of my age, which would be in the 50 zone. I was a big Scooby-Doo fan as a kid. That's, you know, and probably I would bet that's one of the first regular exposures I got to mysteries, even though you don't even realize you're being exposed to mysteries as a kid watching Scooby-Doo's. It's just funny adventures with monsters and a talking dog. But, you know, then you realize later, like, oh, wait, they're actually collecting clues and they're actually, you know, revealing a perpetrator at the end. This is actually a mystery. But, you know, when it came to getting a little older and the sort of Hardy Boys, Nancy Drews of the world, I remember that as a kid, we had all the Hardy Boys on the shelf in my house. And I would occasionally take them down and look at the cover and think, that looks moderately interesting. Perhaps there's two dudes in a boat and they look a bit upset. But there was something that just never quite pulled me in. I think I do remember actually sort of reading the first page of one once. And it just didn't do it for me. So I was not actually a mystery reader as a kid. I read a lot. I read all kinds of other things. But I for whatever reason, I didn't get into mysteries. But my dad was a huge Sherlock Holmes fan and had the, you know, the collected works on the shelf and would pull it down every year. In fact, he had, I don't remember what the name of that specific edition is. It's like a Crown Books or something like that, but it's the entirety of the canon. And it would literally fall apart about once every 5 years because he would read it from cover to cover all over again. And I would pick that up from time to time. I remember reading like The Hound of the Baskervilles when I was about 11-ish or something like that, which is a pretty darn good age for that. And of course, I was aware of the Basil Rathbone movies and would catch those from time to time when they would show up on the TV. So, you know, I was a very informal sort of mystery person. When I got into college, because I had a fondness for old movies, particularly movies from the 40s, just by lucky happenstance, I stumbled upon the fact that the local library had the entire Thin Man movie video collection. And I had never seen those before. And once I started watching them, I could never stop. And I haven't stopped to this day. That was actually a huge pivotal moment for me. It was like just how much I loved those movies and the way they combined the sort of breezy, fun, screwball comedy element with, they're actually, some of them, decent mysteries that hold together pretty well, I think. And so that really planted a seed. And then what happened a few years later was that after I got out of college, I knew that I wanted to do something creative. I felt like I'm a creative person. I should do something artsy or something. So I tried to be a musician briefly, and the challenge with that was that I have absolutely no musical talent whatsoever, which makes being a musician extremely difficult. So after a while, I said, well, like, I was a journalist, and I thought, like, well, okay, I write. Why don't I try writing instead of this playing a trumpet horribly? And because as a kid, I'd actually read a lot more science fiction. I was a very big Star Trek fan, and that had sort of been the gateway to sort of the golden age of science fiction. So I thought it would be a natural transition to go from being a science fiction reader to being a science fiction writer. And what I discovered about that is that as a science fiction writer, I have absolutely no talent whatsoever. So, you know, strike two on being a creative person. And this is the point of my story. And boy, it can take me a while to get to them. Again, I assure everyone that my writing is much more on point. While I was taking a science fiction writing class and feeling like I was floundering a bit, I was in a used bookstore on the north side of Chicago near where I lived. And because I'm a cheap person, I love used bookstores. I love books and I love bargains. So I love used bookstores. And I ran across a copy of The Big Sleep for, it was probably like $1.75 or something. And I thought, that's the price is right. And I've heard of this Chandler guy. And in fact, I'd seen The Big Sleep, now that I think of it, the film version, the Howard Hawks one, and loved it, of course. It's a classic. But I'd never read Chandler and was aware of his reputation. So like, $1.75, you bet. I can recall, as soon as I started reading the first sentence, let alone the first page or the first paragraph, the first sentence just kind of like grabbed me and was like, here's a voice. Here's somebody talking to you. And this guy is pretty funny and smart. And you want to hang out with this guy. You want to hear more of this voice. And it grabbed me in such a way that, sorry, science fiction just doesn't. I like science fiction. I sort of like the idea of science fiction sometimes more than I like the science fiction. And I think it's partially this idea of that kind of voice that you just don't get that often in other genres. But in the mystery genre, you can have that voice, that human being who's just talking directly to you in a very fun way and just walking you through an interesting and intriguing world and adventure. That was a game changer for me. Like, is when I realized, like, oh, wait, you can write this other genre and it can sound like this. Oh, yeah. Yeah. So when I gave up on science fiction not very long after that, I decided to give mystery writing a try. And I sucked at that, of course, for a little while. But the thing that was lovely was that I sucked at it temporarily, I would say, in my humble opinion. You know, another thing that was pivotal in the transition to the mystery genre for me was the fact that there were still existing at that time, two, and there probably were more back then because we're talking about the late 90s, but there were two professional mystery short fiction magazines that were still coming out on a regular basis, Alfred Hitchcock and Ellery Queen. So there was a market. And for me, short fiction was the way to figure out if I could do something, because you're not committing to writing a novel, which is a very long and arduous thing. And if you're going to suck at it, it would really suck to suck for a year and then realize what you have sucks, as opposed to short stories where you can try this and try that and experiment with different approaches and figure out what works for you and if the genre works for you. So I started writing mystery short stories. And after a year of getting rejections, I got an encouraging rejection and then a sale. And then all bets are off. Then it's all off to the races, whatever metaphor one wants to apply. At that point, I realized, well, I guess I've got a lot of reading to do because I actually don't know the mystery genre that well. And I've really got to get myself acquainted with what I'm jumping into here. And once I started doing that, of course, I would have to try Mr. Rex Stout and the Nero Wolfe mystery series. And I can't actually remember exactly when I got around to that. I do remember it was also in that sort of late 90s, maybe early 2000s time. I'm pretty sure before my first novel came out. In fact, I'm fairly sure. And we'll obviously be talking more about Rex Stout and Nero Wolfe. But again, it had that that same effect that the Chandler did of immediately I'm very comfortable and entertained by this voice. And even though the style of mystery is very different between Chandler and Stout, of course, the Stout style was one that was actually very close to sort of a subgenre of the mystery that I really liked, the fair play clue mystery of the sort that you'll find in the Thin Man movies, or another couple movies that I loved as a kid before knowing that I was really a mystery fan, which were the Peter Ustinov Hercule Poirot movies. I loved both Death on the Nile and Evil Under the Sun. And those, I think, are pretty close to the Stout school of mystery construction, and one that I just really enjoy a lot.
So I want to jump back just a little bit because, you know, Rick Stout wrote a ton of short stories and novellas. And I'm just curious because I've talked to Josh Pachter, who has had a lot of his short fiction in Ellery Queen. How important are Ellery Queen and Alfred Hitchcock magazines, do you think, to your fiction career or the careers of other authors? Because I'm just curious about those two publications as a route for writers.
Yeah, I mean, it's different for different writers. I will say that for me, my career would not exist if not for Alfred Hitchcock and Ellery Queen. On the one hand, because I went that route of trying to start with short fiction, which not everybody does. In fact, I now know most don't, but that's how I chose to start. And because I was sort of measuring my progress on, I needed something tangible, you know, to measure it on, because like, at a certain point, you're not quite sure if you're any good at it or not. But if an editor buys the thing, it must be good, at least to a certain level. So that's because that's how I chose to get started. And I got that encouragement fairly early on. That was critical to me. Because I got that encouragement and started making sales, I got better and then established myself. And my mystery novel writing career very much grew directly out of that, because the first Holmes on the Range tale was a short story in Ellery Queen. So if not for that sale and the very lovely response that that story got, that wouldn't have encouraged me to continue that series and eventually turn it into a book series and still have it all these years later. Now, a lot of writers, you know, like I said, they don't start with short fiction at all. They see short fiction as this very separate thing. I don't know. That's just not how it's been for me, because I grew out of starting with short fiction and then made the transition into writing novels. To me, I can jump back and forth. I'm very comfortable in both, but that's not the case for some writers. A lot of writers have started their careers with the short fiction in the magazines, and I think that can still be the case, but it certainly isn't like that's the way you have to go. And a lot, if not most writers, just jump into writing novels and off they go.
Well, and for me, I'm somebody who needs some of that positive feedback, you know? I mean, I don't know. I think waiting a year to send something off and just getting a bunch of rejections would be harder for me as a novelist versus short fiction, where you can kind of just keep trying some new things. I think your strategy, at least for me and probably for a lot of other people who would want to write, is a good one. The other thing for anybody who wants to be a writer that would be listening to this, Ellery Queen does this very cool feature where they'll explicitly putting out first fiction by writers, right?
Department of First Stories. Yeah, absolutely. Which is a wonderful thing. Yeah, that they still will spotlight that and really give people a boost like that. So, you know, and a great thing about short fiction is that all they want are stories that their readers will like. And this is not meant to sound cynical about our friends in New York in the publishing world, but the editors there, you know, they would have to acknowledge it's economics. There's a whole other set of factors at play in terms of what gets published and what doesn't. And simply quality is a factor. It's one of many. But with short fiction, I feel like the doors are open much, much wider. I mean, you still have to figure out what the editor likes, which is basically going to be what they think their readers want. So I think there's a much more sort of direct line from you, the writer, to the reader, and it makes it more sort of pure, right? You can really just focus on not what is the market looking for today, but what is the best example of this kind of story that I can write today.
Well, and the other thing is that you've got a whole host of examples in the magazine to read to say, oh, this is the kind of thing that the editor is looking for. Not that you have to copy and paste, but at least gives you some sort of direction.
Absolutely. And you know, people who don't read Alfred Hitchcock and Ellery Queen, I think, and maybe this is less true than it used to be, people used to make an assumption about what those stories were like, that they were all the same kind of mystery story. And I've been reading those magazines now for 20 years. No, they've always been very diverse. They've always had a lot of different kinds of stories in them. They might be fair play clue mysteries, or they might be suspense tales or biter bit stories. There's a very broad range, actually, in both of those magazines, which again means you can experiment with what you send to them and figure out what works best for you as a writer.
So jumping into Stout, you've written numerous mysteries now. How has writing mysteries changed your view of Stout, if it has at all?
That's a great question. Yeah, it is interesting how once you have written enough books, it changes how you read, sometimes in a not great way, in that it can be, I'll be completely honest, it can be hard for me to read contemporary novels because it's very hard for me to turn off that part of my brain that's always saying, why did you do that? I wouldn't do that. Why did you do it that way? I see what you're doing. You know, and when I'm reading a dead guy or gal, I am much more forgiving. It can make it a more fun experience because I'm not always critiquing or trying to like sort of break it down and analyze it so much. So when I pick up a Rex Stout these days, I'm still, of course, observing what he's doing. But I think a part of it, because he's a dead guy now, sorry, Rex, that keeps it that's in that sort of pure fun realm for me. And I also feel like, and you can at me about this, but when I pick up a Rex Stout Nero Wolfe book, I'm very much expecting a certain kind of experience. And so far, I've always gotten that experience. I know that there are some that sort of break the mold and are more unique than others. But the vast majority, I think, are sort of a kind. And so far, those are the ones I've read. And so it's not like he shook me out of my complacency about like what is a Rex Stout Nero Wolfe book going to be. They are these fun mysteries with great characters that proceed in a very breezy fashion. That's a style that I appreciate a lot. And the things that maybe I've learned over the years reading Nero Wolfe books have less to do with Rex Stout and more to do with myself as a reader, because I do feel like I've gotten to know myself as a reader better. And one thing that I have become aware of actually explains why I sometimes have a problem with Rex is that I am a crazy slow reader. I pretty much read at the sound of speech or at the speed of speech. Everything is narrated in my head, which means it can take me even to read a very short novel, like a Rex Stout 160-page novel. That might take me a week, whereas I know some people sit down and they read a Nero Wolfe and then they get up and they get dinner. And that is not my experience at all. So the upside to Rex for me is because I hear the words in my head, I respond a lot to writers who have a conversational style, and he does. And that again, that goes with him and Chandler, right? That's why that like immediately grabbed me of like, here's somebody talking to me. And that's what my head is doing anyway. So great, so much the better. Now, the downside of that is because I'm such a slow reader, it is very hard for me to track from day one I'm reading a book to day four I'm reading a book, who is who. Because the days have passed and I'm living my life and I'm coming back, you know, late at night and I have half an hour to read and I'm going to pick up The Rubber Band, let's say. And if there are three hysterical white women and four sort of bluff, gruff white dudes, oh my God, they're all going to blur in my head. So it's going to be very hard for me at a certain point to keep track of everybody unless there's reasons, unless, you know, it's written in such a way that everyone is really memorable and it's easier to track who everybody is. It also makes it, of course, a very different experience to try to solve the mystery. Like, it's one thing to watch a Thin Man movie or even, let's say, the original Death on the Nile and be able to figure out the mystery. I'm actually really good at that. It's an hour and a half experience. I see all the wheels in motion and I can figure it out and I'm good like that. Reading a novel, I'm terrible at it. It's been days. I don't remember who went into the parlor with the candlestick. You know, that was days ago I was reading that. And of course, Rex constructs his mysteries like that. So if you want to have any hope of figuring it out for yourself, you're at a great advantage if you're a fast reader and you can hold all those details in your head. And I'm just not. But the thing that, again, is the plus for me is that his characters are so great. You just like spending time with them and watching how they do things. like, of course, Archie and the whole team, right? To see how they all work together in this little world is really a huge part of the fun. And the side characters, I think, are usually memorable enough that that is fun and not burdensome for me. Sometimes, though, it is hard to track everybody. So again, that's less about Rex and more about me.
My wife is very much that way, where she hears the various voices in the book in her head. And I'm always jealous of that because that's not the way I read. You know, I'm more of that quick reader.
Oh, no, I'm jealous of you. Like you just sort of suck it in.
Well, I'm jealous of the people who hear the voices in their head. So I guess it's a two-way street.
I you know, that's an interesting way to describe it. Yes, I am one of those people who hears voices in my head. And that explains a lot about my life.
Well, your Holmes on the Range book's narration, obviously it's influenced by Doyle's Watson, but it has much more humor to it. And so I'm curious, Archie is very much that kind of Watson, but with humor. Was Stout any influence on that at all? Or was that just your own separate creation?
I think it was my own separate creation. I really wish I could remember when I first started reading Rex Stout. Because let me think, the first Holmes and the Range story came out in the early 2000s. It was probably like 2001, I think it was, maybe. That would have been right around the time that I probably first read Rex Stout. I'm pretty sure that it's a happy accident. I think I did my approach first. And then, if I'm remembering right, I picked up Rex Stout and was like, hey, brother, you know, like, yeah, we're doing the same thing. Love it. Because my thought process when I wrote that first Holmes and the Range story was that, you know, I wanted to do a Sherlock Holmes story. And this kind of goes back to the whole thing of Ellery Queen and Alfred Hitchcock magazines and starting with short stories and getting that good feedback of sales, that encouragement of sales. Ellery Queen did and still does every year a Sherlock Holmes tribute issue every year. You know, a big advantage of that is you know that they're looking for Sherlockian stories. So that gives you a leg up. If you write a Sherlockian story, you know that there's a special slot for it and you're going to have maybe a better chance of selling it. So I thought, okay, I want to write a Sherlockian story and I like Sherlock Holmes a lot. So great. But the thing I did not want to do was write a pastiche. So I knew I don't want to write a story about Sherlock Holmes. I do not want to write a story in Watson's voice. So, okay, that means I have to write a story that's Sherlockian, but not about Sherlock, and in a voice that I'm comfortable with, which would be an American voice in particular. So that kind of led me down the path of like, oh, well, okay, who might read Sherlock Holmes and be inspired by that? And what kind of funny story could we get out of that? And when did those stories originally come out? Oh, the late, you know, Victorian era. What was going on in America at that time? The Wild West. Oh, cowboys. Oh, there we go. Once you know that you're going to do a sort of Sherlockian story where you have a brilliant figure who is sort of the sleuth mastermind, you cannot really have that character be your viewpoint character, because then you're seeing all of the wheels turn in that character's head all the time, and it just reveals too much to the reader and would get exhausting. And it's better to have a viewpoint character who's a step back, who's watching the mastermind, and that way you can be giving all the same information to the reader through that viewpoint character, so they have a chance to solve the mystery, but you're not sort of going through that exhausting, spoiler-filled process of seeing it from the viewpoint of the sleuth. So that immediately takes you to a Watson paradigm, which is, of course, exactly an Archie paradigm too. He's the guy who's a step back, who's watching the master sleuth, and he has all the same information. In fact, he's bringing all the information in the Nero Wolf case, bringing all that information to the sleuth, who sees it and puts it together in a way that makes sense. And I just happened to stumble upon the same thing of like, well, there's one cowboy who is brilliant, but I can't have him be the viewpoint character. Well, then he's got to have another cowboy who's less brilliant, not dumb, but less brilliant, and doesn't put it together in the same way, but can be there to observe everything. And he's our viewpoint character. And as long as you're going to have a viewpoint character watching somebody else solve a mystery, you may as well make it fun. So give him a sense of humor. And again, that just takes you right to Archie. So just sort of by accident, my narrator character, Big Red, became an Archie character, I think, because Rex and I were just kind of thinking along the same track.
Well, and given Watson is rather humorless, it's not surprising that folks kind of lean a little bit more into that. It seems like kind of a little bit of a low-hanging fruit.
Yeah, you know, of course, I love Sir Arthur and will be forever grateful to him for his creation of Holmes and Watson, who I love. But yeah, Watson, you know, I won't say that I don't think Watson's boring. And I don't think that Watson is one-dimensional. I think there's something there to Watson. There's a reason we like Watson. But I also think that styles change over the years and reader expectations change over the years. And there's a very straightforward approach to what we would call today genre storytelling that I just don't think you can get away with so much anymore. Or at least this is the stuff I like you couldn't get away with, because genre has been done and done and done and done and done and done. And you can't, it's pretty much impossible to tell a new story. I mean, it's not impossible. Of course, people are pushing those boundaries and doing it, but it's very hard. And if you're going to tell a certain kind of genre story of a sort that we all love, right? We have certain expectations, and you want this kind of story. I think that the way you make that not just another one of those is personality. What I really respond to when I'm reading mysteries is personality. Or actually, when I'm reading anything, I like a writer with personality. And this is a whole other conversation we could get into of this thing called the no style style, which is a way of approaching mysteries or thrillers or other kinds of books that doesn't appeal to me at all as a reader or a writer. So I guess it's to say that you don't have to be going this way that I prefer, of bringing a lot of personality to it, because that's what makes it human, and the human element is what makes it fun and relatable and interesting. But that's just the approach that I like.
Well, I was in New York many years back, and of course, I have to visit all the bookstores and asked for a recommendation at the very cool Partners in Crime bookstore that's now closed. And they recommended your first book. I really enjoyed it, but I loved your second one, The Wrong Track. That's where I felt like everything clicked. And I'm just curious, you know, how hard is it to write a series book versus a standalone? What are some of the positives and negatives of that?
Well, first, thank you so much for that. That's great to hear about your experience. And yeah, gosh, it's sad to think of all the mystery bookstores that existed when I debuted as an author that no longer are with us. And those bookstores really gave me a boost at the time. And it's really lovely to think back on that. The thing that I did with the Holmes and the Range books that you seem to have noted is that every new book for me was a reaction to the preceding book. That every time I wrote a new book in the series, I was trying to do something different than what I did the time before. Although within the same framework, because everyone is still a fair play mystery. And the tone is only going to be able to change so much, because the narrator is always the same, and he's a certain kind of guy, and he has a certain way of talking and a certain way of telling a story. But I tried to change the tone as much as I could from book to book while maintaining the flavor of the narration. For example, in On the Wrong Track, what I said was, well, the first novel was more or less all in one location and had the sort of classic gather everyone in the room climax, which was very much by design, right? I wanted it to have that sort of classic feel. And so it had to build to that kind of climax. So for the second one, I wanted it to be a mystery that moves around, and I wanted it to be a mystery that did not have a gather all the suspects ending, because I'd done that last time. And I also wanted it to surprise readers who read the first book, who would probably come and think that I would just do the same thing over again. And so I very consciously set it up also to have a spoiler alert that, you know, if you're expecting the resolution to the main mystery to come at point X, I'm going to give it to you actually at point P, because it turns out there's this whole other twist that gives you a whole different kind of ending that I also wanted to be more sort of action oriented, as opposed to people talking and having a conflict in a room ending. So all of that wanting to like make things different is why On the Wrong Track became a train mystery. And once you realize, oh, it's a train mystery, that would work. And look at the period, look at the setting. Why not do a train mystery? Well, there's a long tradition of train mysteries, and then you can sort of play around with all the sort of tropes of that and bring your own thing to it. For the book after that, the train had to go somewhere, and where it happened to be going was San Francisco. Okay, well, now we've got a whole different thing, right? Now it's a San Francisco mystery. And so because of, you know, historical context, you know, that sort of, to me, suggested a different, again, a certain kind of approach that was really digging into like the what was going on in San Francisco at the time, which had a lot to do with sort of politics and racism. That gives you a different kind of story, one that's darker I guess you could call it grittier, although I never like try to be gritty. But so the third book, The Black Dove, is then a response to the book before it of like, no, now we're all going to be in a city, and it's going to be about being in this city and dealing with the political and racial realities of this city at this time, which makes it, again, a darker, more tragic story, etc. So like every time, and then all the way up to the fifth book, World's Greatest Sleuth, which I should shout, I guess, because it has an exclamation mark at the end of it, and which I should also point out, plug, was a finalist for the Nero Award. So thank you, Wolfpack, acknowledging my acknowledgement of Stout. That, you know, World's Greatest Sleuth was where I sort of decided like the preceding two books were too dark. Well, not too dark. They were very dark compared to the first two books. So like, this is going to be our light, fluffy, fun concoction. They're all books that have a lot of humor in them, but I would say none of them are comedies. I'm not writing comedies. I'm writing mysteries with a lot of humor. And to me, that's very different because it means I always take the plot super, super seriously. And despite all the humor, I take the characters seriously. So it's not just all about yuck-yucks. But if there's one that comes closest to being a comedy, but it's not a comedy, it would be World's Greatest Sleuth. It's the lightest of them all. And then the one after that, AA Western Detective Agency, that was one where I decided, after taking a long break from the series and coming back to it, that I wanted to really lean into the Westernness of it, that you could look at the first couple and call them Westerns. They're not really Westerns. They're historical mysteries that just happen to take place in the Old West. But there's a lot of obviously Western flavor in them. I guess the fourth book, Crack in the Lens, you could also say is Western-y. But I really wanted to like double down on the Westernness of it while also still having a fair play mystery plot. So that's why the sixth book is consciously veering away from World's Greatest Sleuth, which was set in Chicago during the Columbian Exposition. So it has that is very much what it's all about, which gives it this whole different flavor. So like now we're going to be in a little town in the West dealing with the sorts of issues that one runs across in that kind of story, but with a fair play mystery plot. So yada, yada, yada. Long-winded answer to your question is I keep it fresh for myself, which hopefully keeps it fresh for the audience by always doing something different in every book, even though the reader's baseline expectations of what kind of story is this going to be, fair play mystery, and who's going to be there, Big Red and Old Red, and will I be entertained in that same way? Yes, hopefully. So all of that is always there. But the settings are always different and the tone is always a little different.
Well, I've loved the series. I'm a Chicago guy, so of course World's Greatest Sleuth is one of my favorite. But it leads me to my next question, talking about how you keep things fresh, because I'm curious your opinion about keeping characters basically static, which I would say Wolf and Archie are. They're kind of locked in amber for most of their run. They don't age. You don't see their personalities really dramatically changing or having characters change over time, because it's really kind of fallen out of fashion, I would say, that style of writing. And so I'm curious your opinion as a writer.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right to say that it has fallen out of fashion. And it kind of goes back to that point I was talking about earlier about how approach to genre has changed over the years. And it's, you know, about readers' expectations. And the expectation used to be that they would be locked in amber, that they would be almost sort of like classical mythological heroes who are always the same. And so whenever you return to them, you want them to sort of not have changed in any way. Yeah, I'm trying to think, like, what could we pin this on? I don't know. We'd have to bring in, I guess, a professor of comparative literature to talk about why this change happened. But it absolutely happened that readers now expect their characters to change and grow and progress and for their lives to look a little bit. I don't want to call it realistic, but they want it to feel more like the progression of a life and to see it go places. And so, yeah, absolutely. That's been reflected in my books that the characters aren't so much changing, but their circumstances change. They're changing slightly. The thing with the Holmes and the Range series is that if you look at the timeline of the first story through the most recent story, and I'm happy to say that stories are still coming out in Ellery Queen today, I think it goes from like 1891, at the moment I'm up into early 1894. I think maybe the first one was in 1892. So it's over the course so far of like a little more than 2 years. So there's only so much that can change. And I guess even though again, their circumstances are changing a lot, and where you find them in the sixth novel is different than where you find them at the beginning of the first novel. But I feel like I've just reached the point now after six novels and, oh my God, 10 or 12 stories, where the changes are going to start coming. You know, they're set up in a way that they never were before. They were sort of drifters, my lead characters. And now I've set them down somewhere. And it's almost like now the series really starts. And now there's things that are sort of baked into the characters, like the fact that Old Red, the brilliant sleuth of the two lead characters, is illiterate. That gave the other character a reason to be around, gave him something to do, like he could always help his brother. It gave the sleuth a big challenge to overcome. So those are good things. But then you have to answer the question sooner or later of like, well, now they've got a home finally, they've got a sort of career started finally. Wouldn't he learn how to read? If he can't learn how to read, why can't he not learn it? What's the deal with that? So I finally have to sort of like start addressing that, which is something I'm starting to do in the newest stories that are coming out. You do have to these days have some progress. And certainly I've heard from enough readers who are very anxious for certain things to happen. They really want Old Red to learn how to read, and they really want some love. They really want those poor down on the luck brothers to have some luck and love finally. I feel like, yeah, those are both things I really just have to do sooner or later. And, you know, the big advantage, there's many big advantages to doing that, is like, keep your readers happy advantage, keep yourself interested advantage, by giving the characters internal lives and the capacity to change. But what I wouldn't want to do is have that sort of overwhelm the nature of what the stories are. Like, it's not a soap opera. It's not a drama. These are adventure stories, adventure mystery stories. And that's what they always will be. So the other stuff sort of has to kind of fit in around the periphery. But I'm finding ways to do that.
Thinking about Rex Stout and Nero Wolfe, the last book was published in 1975. And there's still a passionate fan base out there, which is, to me, pretty amazing. I'm curious, you know, what do you think gives some writing some staying power and others not? And it's a pretty rare thing, right?
It's very rare. And that's really an interesting question. Not that all the others weren't. They've all been fascinating. But this is one where I really have to kind of stop and, yeah, like, think about it. Maybe because I'm not talking about myself, finally. But what is the secret to that? I'll kind of try to hash it out here, and you tell me what you think, because there could be different explanations. One could be simple nostalgia, that, you know, he represents a certain age, a golden age, one could maybe even say, but a certain age of the mystery, that despite the way things might have changed in sort of modernity or post-modernity, there's still a great deal of appeal. I mean, it's the same reason, like, why do people still read Arthur Conan Doyle? Why do people love the world of Sherlock Holmes and returning to that? And there's a lot of reasons for it. And some of it's baked into, you know, the great characters and the great setup. And I think a lot of it's baked into attachment to the Victorian age, which these guys are, you know, Holmes and Watson are sort of, in some respects, the perfect avatars of, and a nostalgic attachment to characters that you grew up loving. So that just have always been sort of been around. Now, you know, Stout is, you know, I don't actually know to what degree new readers are discovering Rex Stout. I hope and pray that new readers are discovering Rex Stout. I know, of course, that new readers are discovering Conan Doyle, but that's because largely a function of broader media, of TV and movies. That because Sherlock Holmes is still a very visible public domain figure who can get used this way and used that way and get stuck in people's, you know, in front of people. So there's always opportunities for new people to stumble into them and discover them. Obviously, that's not quite the same for Nero Wolfe, who's not out there in the same way. Do you think more readers are discovering Stout, or is it that readers of a certain age, when they return to the things that they love, Stout's going to be one of them just because he was so great?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, there was a TV show, which I think helps always, right? You know, getting that kind of bump from other media. And so I think that helped folks find him. And now, you know, I don't know. I think you're right. There is some of that nostalgia from folks. I don't know how many new people are finding him. I'm not sure. I know I'm new to the series. The whole shtick in this podcast is I have a friend who grew up reading the novels and they really wanted to talk about them. And so I'm the newbie and they're the expert, longtime reader. And so that's, we kind of talk through each of the books. But
well, I will just jump in to say, and you can tell me if I'm wrong, that in terms of like, why would Rex Stout live on in a way that John Dixon Carr or, you know, other people maybe actually very much less so. And I think it goes back to what I was talking about earlier in terms of like what jumped out at me about Raymond Chandler, the voice. What jumps out at you when you start reading the Archie Goodwin as the narrator? It's a fun voice. That does not change. And so if new readers give him a chance, I would think that Rex Stout's books would have a much greater shot at being appealing to a modern reader because you have a fun, informal narrator. And that's going to open that door, I think, much wider. And it goes back to the thing I was saying also about sort of like personality, you know, looking for personality in a book. And that's what modern readers, I think, well, not all of them, but a lot of them respond to. And boy, oh boy, you can pick up a lot of mysteries from the 30s, 40s, 50s that are either, you know, poorly written, or poorly written only sort of from our modern perspective in the sense of like being flavorless and void of humanity and that sort of mechanical nature to mysteries. I know there are some people who still just actually love the pure mystery, the mechanisms of it. That not for me. And again, I think that goes to like the kind of reader I am. I read slowly. I can't track all these details. That's not what appeals to me. What appeals to me are these fun, interesting characters going through interesting experiences. So that is going to be in Stout. And I think that is what will keep Stout relevant longer than others.
Well, and even Stout himself tried to write other mysteries before and after writing the Nero Wolf series, and none of them broke through because I think you're right. They didn't have that voice of Archie.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I've never sampled any of those. But yeah, from what I know of them, that was the impression I got, is that they just didn't have the magic. They didn't have the flair. And without the magic and the flair, I'm not really going to love it.
I'm curious because Wolf is the kind of person that you love reading about but wouldn't necessarily want to hang out with, more so than even Holmes was. And what do you think the trick was there? How did Stout pull that off?
Well, that's a great question. I think that he pulled it off in a few ways. One was by having characters around him that you like. One was, it's a fine line that you can see how if you're feeling to somebody like Wolf, he'd be insufferable. But when you read the sort of foibles or crankiness on the page and it's presented through Archie's point of view, it becomes funny and endearing. And I think you could probably say the same of many things. Like if the Golden Girls were your neighbors, you might hate them. They might just annoy the crap out of you because maybe as real people, some of those characters would be super annoying. But when it's presented to you in the context of a sitcom where they are unreal characters that you're observing, then it's fun. And you're very forgiving. In fact, you love the foibles because they're funny. So I think with Wolf, that's very much the case. Like if you think about his foibles, and I'm sure this could be pointed out in many books where I'm wrong in saying this, but like they're not integral to the plot. They don't, you know, they don't have a bearing on what happens, or even they have a bearing on how things happen, but they don't have a bearing on what happens. Why are they there? They're there for flavor. They're there to make him unique and to give Archie a reason to exist and to do what he does and to give the stories a reason to be structured the way they are. So they're all sort of a function of entertainment. And I think that in that way, they work for readers who just sort of take them in that spirit. Whereas, again, if you had a character who was Nero Wolf in a literary novel or a drama, he would just be some I don't know if I can say asshole. He'd just be some asshole you hate. But in the context of a mystery where he's the brilliant guy who works with the wisecracking gumshoe to crack the case, you love him.
Yeah, no, you're right. And I think you're right. The framing of it is what lets it work. And any other way, it would not be as enjoyable.
Yeah, that's the magic of that. And I'm sure that we could find examples, many from the mystery genre where it just didn't work, where people were trying to do that thing of presenting that kind of character and you just hate him. But there's something about Wolf, I think, in that context, in relationship to Archie and the rest of the gang, and in those kinds of the way that Stout does those stories, you just love it.
So I've been asking this of some other folks that I've talked to. I'm curious, has the pandemic changed your view of Nero Wolf, given his locking himself in his house? You know, I mean, it's kind of the ultimate pandemic read, looking back on it.
Oh, man, that's hilarious. Well, see, that's a great thought. And it seems to me like, well, that's, you know, if you're going to go do your Netflix pitch for a reboot of Nero Wolf, this is how you do it. You've got a brilliant detective who is now agoraphobic because of the pandemic. And so he has to rely on his gopher, trying to think of what the new name would be. It wouldn't be Archie, or it'd be Archie with no E, because it would be, you know, his female detective operative who has to go out into the world and operate for him or her, for Narina Wolf, and then, you know, bring that back. That seems like a perfect setup. And, you know, obviously it's so perfect that people have ripped it off over the years and basically done Nero Wolf without doing Nero Wolf, without having to pay the estate or anything like that. So yeah, no, it seems like, boy, yeah, no, a great detective mind who won't leave the house. Never has there been a better time for that. And we'll see who gets to that reboot or steal opportunity first.
I know you haven't read them all, but of the ones you have read, is there a specific favorite novel that you've had in the series?
The ones that I just read most recently was The Rubber Band. And I really liked that one a lot. I went into it with a little trepidation because I can remember, you know, the challenge that I mentioned earlier of like keeping all the characters straight and keeping all of the minutiae straight of who was in what room when. I remember that Champagne for One, I didn't love for that reason of like, there's all these white couples in this room and I cannot keep them straight. And I don't have the brain to remember who put on what jacket after taking which cocktail. I mean, oh God, don't make me try to remember that. Not when I'm reading, you know, not when it's going to be over the course of a week. If I'm watching a movie, I can track it. It's like, hey, the blonde guy, right? Because that's all I got to remember is the blonde guy. But when it's George Simpson, it's like, how is George Simpson different from James Johnson? Like, oh my, too many boring white guys. But yeah, no, The Rubber Band had a lot of like fun flavor and memorable characters, and that helped me keep everything straight. So of course I could not solve the mystery, could not figure it out. Oh, and I will say, okay, love you, Rex. The thing of snapping the rubber band and it's a gunshot. Oh, come on. You know, he had like three different ways that the metaphor of the rubber band works, right? There's a band of people and there's some involved with a guy named Rubber. Okay, I'll buy it. That's a bit of a stretch, but okay, there you go. Mission accomplished. You don't need more than that. But then there was another one in there somewhere that I don't remember. But then like, sorry, everybody, spoiler alert, if you haven't read this one yet, but somebody like snaps a rubber band by the mouthpiece of a phone and that makes somebody think a gunshot has gone off. And it's like, maybe this person's really been practicing their rubber band snapping, but I don't see that at all. So, of course, you can't solve that because who could? But aside from my quibbles about elements like that, I really enjoyed the rubber band. I don't remember all the details of the doorbell ring, but, you know, in terms of talking about how Stout did or didn't sort of change up his formula over the years, I remember, if I'm remembering the doorbell ring correctly, because it's been many years since I read it, that's the one where he takes on the FBI, right?
I think so. I haven't gotten that far. I'm the newbie, but yeah.
Oh, okay. Then again, I'm sorry. Spoiler alert. I'm pretty sure that's a book where in a very timely fashion, I think it was written in the early to mid 60s, yeah, if I'm remembering right. And it's a daring book. He took this genre story style that's all sort of filled with sort of tropes and expectations, and he applied it in a way that wouldn't have been popular with a lot of his readers, to make a direct critique on a guy in office, Hoover, who was a piece of shit. And that's another thing that I don't know if you guys have ever gotten into this about Stout, but I very much admire Stout's politics and the way that he stood up for them throughout his entire life in a way that I don't, because I don't want to get into that with people. I'm a coward. But Stout was not a coward. And, you know, he was a fighting liberal and, you know, so and went took it all the way to directly critiquing the Federal Bureau of Investigation in one of his fun little mystery books. Again, in a way that would have really turned off a not unsizable chunk of his audience who was all for the FBI crushing that nasty civil rights movement. So yada, yada, yada. There's at least one example of a book where I think Stout did switch things up, if I'm remembering correctly, and then brought in something that he didn't all the time, which was, you know, like political commentary. Although if I'm remembering it right, again, he didn't do it in like a super heavy-handed way. Boy, all of the Nero Wolfe fans are going to tear me up for this. Because I could be totally misremembering the whole thing. And that if he had brought in, I think, his very strong political views into every book, you know, it would have ruined it, you know, for everybody. It just like, then it becomes polemic and, you know, either you disagree with him and you hate him or you're tired of him preaching to the choir. And he didn't do that. He did not make that mistake. He kept those things mostly very separate, even though he was very active with his politics again all through his life. The Nero Wolfe books were this very separate thing. But at least the one time that I'm aware of that he really drew it in, I really admire him for that.
Yeah, I mean, I think for me, the ones that I've enjoyed the most are where he's really had a very distinct kind of milieu, if I'm going to use some sort of fancy word that I probably pronounced wrong.
But that's how I would have mispronounced it. So we're in the same boat.
But, you know, like where there's this radio show kind of that he's going to, or and Archie's interacting with these people, or some specific kind of business or things like that, where you get the sense that he kind of knew the background and could really develop that as a setting. Those are the ones that I find interesting. And it kind of plays back to some of what you were talking with your mysteries, where the setting really affects the story and how everything is going to play out, which is something that I appreciate.
Yeah, I mean, it goes to show how much he was able to mix it up, despite the fact that it could have very easily been fat dude in room, you know, for 60 books. And it is sort of that, but it's not, because Archie is getting out, as you say, into different milieu, whatever the plural of milieu is, and is getting out. And again, I haven't read widely enough in the series to know, like, what percentage of the books actually do sort of succumb to that a possible failing of one more book of running around Manhattan and Archie bringing details back to fat guy in room who solves it by talking for three chapters. I've read at least one of those. And even that one, I'm sure I found entertaining, you know, just less so than you're right, than those other ones where he's able to, you know, like the rubber band again, like it's got the sort of Western backstory, but it's also got a sort of a story that deals with, at that time, contemporary European politics, and not in a heavy handed way, but is acknowledging some of the realities of, you know, 1930s Europe. And that brings more flavor to it, that brings more of interest to it.
Was there anything else on Wolfe that you wanted to make sure we chatted about here that I haven't brought up?
Well, let me think here. You know, I did realize that maybe I did read Stout before I got too far into the Holmes on the Range series, because I do know that Old Red, the brilliant detective of the two protagonists, he has a stock phrase for when his brother says something he finds absurd or useless or annoying, and that is "fick." And that, maybe I stumbled onto that by accident, but once I did see that Wolfe has his own phrase for such moments, then I know that going forward, I was very aware of, like, you know, here is Old Red having his Nero Wolfe moment, because he's not going to say "fooey," he's going to say "fick." So yeah, somewhere early on, I must have run across that. I don't know if you guys will, maybe when you get to the end of all of the Nero Wolfe books, I don't know if you then will start looking for ways to broaden out the podcast, or if you will collapse exhausted and retire. But I know that William L. DeAndrea wrote a couple of books that were very much Western mysteries inspired by Nero Wolfe, and pretty much like direct attempts to lift Nero Wolfe and set him in the Old West. Please tell me if I'm telling you something you already know. There's a character called Lobo Black. Mm. Believe it or not, is Nero Wolfe, basically, but in the Old West. And I'm pretty sure I didn't stumble onto those the existence of those because there were only two of them until after I started my series. So it's, hey, everybody, I didn't steal it. I did not steal it. He happened to have a similar idea long before I did. Because I think those, well, maybe not even that long. I think those books came out in like the late 80s or early 90s. I read the second of them. It was called Fatal Elixir. And I'm afraid all I remember is that I didn't really care for it. But it'd be interesting for you guys, maybe if you're looking to do a change up at some point, if you want to look at other works that were inspired by Stout, that would be one to look at.
All right. Well, I'll have to do that. Where can folks find you if they want to keep up with you and what you're working on? And anything else coming out recently or in the near future that you want to plug?
Well, thank you so much for the opportunity to plug. Always great to get people commodified. I can be caught up with, of course, at stevehawkinsmith.com. And that has information on all my different books and stories. And there's a news page there so folks can see what I'm up to.
And Steve has just had all of his Homes on the Range books reissued with new covers, new releases out there right now. And a brand new book, Hunters of the Dead, is out on October 17th. I'm excited to read it. It's all about a mystery involving dinosaur bone hunters out in the Wild West. It sounds like a really fun read. And I know there's even more books on the horizon in the series. So I'm really excited to rejoin Big Red and Old Red in reading some more of the Wild West mystery series, Homes on the Range.
You know, having read much of your work, you know, there's, for folks who haven't read you before, there's a lot of things to dive into. The Homes on the Range series is great. You've got a tarot mystery series, which is kind of a little more, I think, Lawrence Block, Donald Westlake-esque kind of grifter kind of a thing, if I'm remembering correctly.
Yeah, no, those books are very much a different kind of style. And they were mystery novels that where I wanted to get away from the fair play puzzle mystery, the sort of Christie aspect that I always keep alive in the Holmes and the Range stories. And you're right, it is more sort of in the crime school of a Lawrence Block, where, you know, there's a mystery, but it's not based on, you know, sort of like, why were the wax drippings on the chicken, you know, kind of thing. And, you know, but they're also sort of like semi-cozy. They were intended to be cozy-ish, but I don't think I can write a fully straight cozy just because I'm me and I always have to make it a little more odd than that, but or a little more something. But they do have, like the Holmes and the Range novels and like the Nero Wolf novels, they have a first-person narrator who has a sort of distinct sense of humor that hopefully makes it fun for the same people who would enjoy the Homes on the Range stuff.
Great. Well, and there's a bunch of short story collections as well that are on Amazon. Download them on your Kindle, and they're a good jumping on point, I'd say.
Excellent. Well, thank you for saying that. Yeah, I do hope folks, you know, I know short fiction doesn't have the same following. You know, everybody loves novels. I'm the same way. I love novels. I love short stories too, but you know, novels are like the go-to. But I love that short fiction is still an avenue for people because it is a chance to get like a potpourri, or like a smorgasbord, a little bit of this and a little bit of that, both as a writer and a reader.
Well, I'll have links to all of this in the show notes for folks to find if you're curious, and I encourage you to look up Steve and all of his various Twitter, Facebook, and web presence. That's all for this episode of Like the Wolf. If you enjoyed the show, please subscribe to the show in your favorite podcast app. Take a minute to review our show wherever you listen to podcasts. It'll help show wolf fans that this is one to listen to. Steve, don't forget that agreement I had you sign that mandates a review in the fine print. So take care of that.
Absolutely. And don't forget the agreement that also says you have to edit out all of my long-winded stupidity.
I'll get right on that.
It's going to take a lot of editing.
Follow us on Twitter at LikeWolf or visit us online at likethewolf.com. Until next time, thanks for listening. Like what you're listening to? There's more like it. Barbican Station explores the spy world of Slough House and the Slow Horses created by author Mick Herron. Find it online at slough.house or in your favorite podcast app under Barbican Station. Spybrary's Spy Rewind uses one episode of a classic spy TV show like Mission Impossible
Alias, or Get Smart to talk about the show as a whole. It's at spybrary.com or search for Spybrary in your podcast app. Exploring the works of John le Carré, each episode of the Le Carré Cast looks at a specific novel or an unexplored aspect of his life and work. Join us as we take a deep dive into the world of espionage John le Carré has revealed. Search for Le Carré Cast wherever you listen to podcasts or at lecarrecast.com. They're all novel podcasts, and you can find them all if you type novel.network in your browser. That's novel.network.